courses I fit them very well.
Start again. Okay, so the topic for tonight is the Aguna problem. Agunas in the olden days are people who were missing at war, missing at sea. And I'll start with a story that when I became involved in this prenuptial agreement as a way to solve what we call the modern day Aguna problem, I had the privilege to meet with a great Talmud Chacham named Rav Moshe Halberstam, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. Rav Moshe Halberstam was a Rav who belonged to the Badat of Eira Charedis, but he had a much more, a broad approach that he was allowed to let on publicly. I will not say more than that, but there are many stories which can be told about this. So he met me and he told me the following story. He said he once, in a light moment, asked the Av Bezin, the Rav Yitzchok Yaakov Weiss, Zatzal, the author of Minchas Yitzchok, who was Av Bezin in the Eidah Haredis of Bezin Shalayim for, I believe, 17 years or approximately. He asked him, why were you Zaycha to become the Av Bezin of the Eidah Haredis of Yerushalayim? He was plucked from Manchester, England. And what just happened? You know, how did it happen? What did you? It's a bit of a chutzpah, such a question. He said, but you know, he asked him in a light moment. So he thought about it, took the question seriously, thought about it a little bit. He said, you know, perhaps because after World War II, he spent many, many hours, days, weeks, months, trying to find a heter for all the agunas that were left after World War II. He was famous, was Diane Weiss, in his part of the world, as was Rav Moshe in our part of the world, as were certain Choshev Rabbonim, Rav Kahan, among others, in Eretz Yisrael, and they were trying to find leniencies. He told me this story when I approached him, it's probably close to 20 years ago, about this issue. He was very sympathetic to our prenuptial agreement, which we'll discuss this evening. We asked him to sign on to it, and he said in a nice way, that, you know, he just can't do these things because of where he sits. But not that he was in favor as a silent endorser, for whatever that's worth, but he couldn't. I thought I would never deal with old-fashioned lagunas ever, because in Eretz Yisrael, there's war, what do we have in this country? This country's safe, right? Little did I know that, now it's again, believe it or not, almost 10 years ago, we're now in 2011, and at the end of, as you all well know, in September 11th, 2001, with the terrible tragedy of the Twin Towers, where our Bezin was given 8 separate Aguna problems, each one of which was a serious issue, not simple at all. We never thought we'd have to deal with this ever. We had to deal with each one of the cases. And once again, I went back to Rabbi Halberstam about these Agunas. He told me the same story again. He forgot he told me the same story last time. The same story of trying to help out Agunas. That time he sent me to Rabbi Vosner. That's not a topic for this evening, but it's a whole discussion. In any event, the modern day Aguna problem is a man who's very much alive, as we say in America, alive and kicking. Alive and kicking because he refuses to give a get, even when the halacha requires him to give one. Now I want to explain that the word Aguna has been abused and perverted. Because every woman says, I'm an aguna. But it's not necessarily the case. A woman is an aguna, but she's entitled by Jewish law to receive a get, and the get is not forthcoming within a reasonable period of time. That's an aguna. But not every single woman who insists on a get is necessarily an aguna. For example, generally speaking, for a woman to be entitled to have her get, she has to be what we call a tzaisa ledina. She wants to follow the orders of a bezdin. But if she does not want to follow the orders of the Bezin at all, any other matters, she just wants to get, it's not at all clear that she's, quote, entitled to the status of an aguna. And that's very sad. But it's a reality. So, again, notwithstanding the precise definition of aguna, it's certainly a problem that we have to deal with, because even if it exists once, it's once too many. I must say that it was in the New York Times or something like that, someone wrote an article about agunas in America, and they said there were 100,000 agunas. You know, you want to make up numbers, there's nothing to stop you. But that's obviously an absurd figure. How many there are, I can't give you a precise answer. There are a few, and every single one of them, our heart bleeds. We try very hard to stop this problem. And frankly, my involvement with this, we'll call modern day Aguna issue, harkens back over 20 years when we had a particularly difficult case in our own community. And I told my Talmidim, we were learning Masechta Gittin that year, ironically, we were learning Masechta Gittin. And it was, you know, Gittin's a very lumdus, yeshivish and Masechta, a lot of lumdus. I told my fellows, after Pesach, no more lumdus. Let's set our minds to figure out what can we do about this problem going forward. How can we solve women in the future from falling into this situation of being an aguna, a case in which her husband is alive and well and refuses to give a get for whatever reason, either out of spite or out of a failure to recognize the reality that his marriage is over, or out of greed. There could be many other reasons as well. How do we put an end to this to the best of our ability? So what happened was that there had been up to that point quite a few suggestions. I wasn't the first one to wake up in 1990 and think, hey, what do we do about this? There were many other suggestions. I want to go through some of the suggestions with you to explain why the suggestions are good but not quite sufficient. The first suggestion, I'm going chronologically in my conceptual way, was the problem solved already. How is the problem solved? Why should a man hold his wife in aguna when there is a running obligation upon him to support her? After all, we read 2 weeks ago, Parshas Mishpatim, She'erok susav onasolo lo yigra. He has a supporter. Not only that, but he himself agreed in a document form to support her. Right? We spoke about it recently. He accepted upon himself to support her. According to Hichos Guvin Yudon, as all Jewish men do. So there's an obligation to support her. So the obligation to support her exists. She should just summon him to a bezdin, to a secular court even. That's the point, the secular courts have power to support her as he agreed. And instead of supporting her, he's more likely to give her a get. It's such an elegant and beautiful solution. And therefore, one of the rabbis, in fact, translated the Ksuba into English. And he said, I'm going to have to support you. And he wants to have it in English, and it should be notarized, and to be therefore, how should we say it, enforceable in the court of law. It's terrific. It's great. Okay, let him sign it. So he'll sign what's written in the Ksuba. He'll sign himself. He just had a shiur from Rabbi Cohen today about whether he has to sign it, whether Adam has to sign it. If witnesses sign it, I think that he accepted it, would probably be good even in American law. And as a matter of fact, there's a particular translation which says, quote, in case of separation or abandonment by the husband, all the above obligations remain in full force till the completion of all divorce proceedings and the removal of all impediments to remarriage of the wife. Okay? That's all. The problem is that this is not written in the Ksuba. That's not a translation. That is an addition. But it's not written in the Ksuba. What is the halacha as far as that's concerned? What is the halacha? If a couple breaks up, is the man required to support his wife when she's no longer in his house? Yes or no? So the Ramah gives a clear psak in Evan Ezer, Simon Ayin Sifyud Beis. It depends whose fault it is. If it's his fault, he has to pay her. If it's her fault, he need not pay her. Now, we all know, very well know, that Hamotzi Mechaveh Olav Araya, so she wants the money, she has to prove that it's not her fault. And as a result of that, it's unlikely that it's ever going to come to pass. So it's a very good, it's a good try, but it's just not enough. Not enough. Now, there are others who claim that the mere fact that she is prevented from remarriage by the fact that she's married to him, this in and of itself engenders an obligation of support. This is a very serious halachic dispute. Not everyone agrees to it. When it comes to disputed matters, which are disputed, I should say, not by anybody, because everything's a dispute, but disputed by the classical authorities, it's not at all clear that this obligation is in full effect. Now, more than that, the question becomes, even if he's obligated to support her, but he's also entitled to her earnings, and therefore, as we've learned in the Gemara Shir, if her earnings are significant, and many, many women, Baruch Hashem, today have significant earnings, so then it's a wash. So again, he's not going to have to give her a penny. This, of course, is a matter of issue, how much he's entitled to, earnings outside the home, earnings more than she would normally achieve with her basic parnasa. It's a discussion. Nonetheless, the wife can overcome it by saying what we call eni nizon esvieni osa. We learned that. She can say, I'm not going to give you, you won't support me, and don't, I won't give you my earnings. But then again, she loses the support of the ksuba. So again, it's a wash. So these solutions simply don't work. Rav Moshe has one shuv about this, in which he permits a prenuptial arbitration agreement. It's a shuv to Rabbi Per, Rosh Hashiva of Yeshiva Farakaway. Rabbi Per saw what's going on. There are many couples that break up, and the first thing about the breakup was a fight. Who should adjudicate their dispute? So at the very least, you can write a prenuptial agreement, and in case of a breakup, we'll arbitrate in a particular bezdin. Makes sense? Makes perfect sense. Rav Moshe permits it. The question, of course, becomes how much is it to encourage it, the different versions of his tshuva, three different versions. We're not going to go into those small details, but I certainly recommend that it be done. Rabbi Per, to my knowledge, to this day, insist on it. They should go to a particular bezdin. And it's very, very helpful, because at least it stops the fight over what will be the court of jurisdiction. Yes?
What are the penalties if you violate that treaty?
That's the problem. The problem is that you agree to go to a particular court of arbitration, and the question becomes, what if you don't show up? So it's possible, although I don't think it's explicit in Rabbi Peer's text, that the court that's been appointed can make a ruling in your absence. You don't come, but you're ready. If you have a dispute with somebody and you sign an arbitration agreement, right? And then you don't show up. But once you sign an arbitration agreement, it's possible. In some cases, they can reach a decision in your absence, almost by default. But that's a question which, of course, is a complicated one. It's not so simple. Now, nonetheless, it's not completely clear what the court would do, the secular court, if the husband refuses to honor the agreement. And let's say he doesn't show up. So what are they going to do with him? They'll say, we give you a default judgment against you. What's the judgment? What? What are they going to say? I guess they can say, has to pay mazonos. That's legitimate. They say, we declare mazonos as X amount. What do you think a secular court does? They say this thing called alimony or child support. They give a number. We'll put it on this number. You have to pay this number. And finish. Pay the number. And every single week or month, you have to pay X dollars. What does that mean?
Well, they have the power for the state father to enforce a decision of the
Bezdin. Every state will almost inevitably support an arbitration agreement. The stretch over here is that the arbitration agreement preceded the marriage. And it's not clear, to my knowledge, there's no case law on this, as to whether a secular court will or will not enforce an arbitration agreement. Which is just, you know, to go to a particular court without any more details.
In the Diamond Dealers Club,
right.
And I think across the whole world, all the Diamond Dealers Club, when you join, you write down that if there's a disagreement with another member of the club, you have to go to the arbitration committee rather than a court. And you're responsible to do this. Now, of course, it happens, but it happens also that people decide not to go.
What happens then?
There's really very little power that they have over you.
Who? The arbitration committee?
Yeah, I don't think the Diamond Dealers Club goes to the court and petitions that he has, that he's fine. I never heard it happen.
That's the way it works. What works is that if you start an arbitration proceeding based on an arbitration agreement, if you serve the person properly, whatever that might mean, then when the arbitration board reaches its decision, if the person doesn't follow that decision, then you can go to court and say, I want the court to enforce it. Courts are the basic proposition in American law, certainly, is they prefer arbitration.
They go home earlier at night.
There's a court system.
They want it. They would usually enforce it.
So then you have to go to court.
No, the difference is, Eddie, it's very interesting to me what you're talking about, because your system is comparable to this. In other words, not that Reuven and Shimon had arbitration, but... It's 10 years earlier. You joined the club 10 years ago. Everything was fine for 10 years. Now you're fighting with someone who wasn't even born at that time. But it's still binding. And if the court will enforce that, it'll be very helpful for our case. But it's something comparable. One second. So therefore, this is a serious issue. Of course, the problem becomes what happens if the husband, for example, refuses to comply, but if he doesn't want to give a get, nothing to do about it. But if the Bezdin can enforce a support agreement, that will be an incentive for him to give a get. There are various other suggestions. I'll give you one of them. I'm quoting: in the event of any breach of this contract, the injured party shall be entitled to injunctive or mandatory relief directing specific performance of the obligations concluded herein, which means he agreed to give a get. There's only one problem with that. We have a lawyer here. What happens if you don't follow it? What is the injunctive or mandatory relief? What can it include? You agree to give a get. So I'm the wife, I'm the injured party, shall be entitled to injunctive or mandatory relief directing specific performance of the obligation to give a get. And if not, Your Honor, well, then what do they can do? You're in contempt. Right? It's the only thing they can do for you. And what happens if you're in contempt?
You potentially get thrown in jail.
Exactly. You get thrown in jail. The problem with that is that maybe what we call a get me'usa, a get which is given under threat of jail, is considered to be, generally speaking, an invalid get. That's why this text, as noble and as it is, seems to me to run afoul of the get me'usa issue.
But it doesn't happen in Israel, they put them in jail.
No, in Israel they put them in jail only in cases, those rare cases, which rise to the level of kofin. There are cases in the Gemara where the person could be literally forced by force, with a whip, to give the get. And in Israel, they will not take a whip to him. It's against their basic democratic law. I mean, in a certain Hasidic circles where they are not bound by that, but in a democracy they are. But they can put him. They can incarcerate him. They can. Yes, sir. Well, in Eretz Yisrael, the Beis Din has the force of secular law behind it. If a Beis Din Rabbani will say he goes to jail, he goes to jail. Not in America, we don't have any such powers. That's for sure.
So, and also earlier you said that the wife can have him summoned to a secular court.
Whoa.
You said earlier.
No. As Mr. Nussbaum clarified, if the arbitration agreement is reached by a Beis Din, the arbitrators, a secular court will enforce their decision. That's a big difference. Enforcement is okay. You read 2 weeks ago, Ela Meshpat Meshatosim Lefneim, Lefneim, Alo Lefneim, Ovdik Achavim. You can't have them decide the case, you can have them enforce the decision of a rabbinical court. You're asking a very good question, which is not the topic for today, but I'll summarize. The question is better than the answer. Every answer I can give, the question is better. So let's put that aside for the moment. And there are those who claim of a different draft. Quote, inability to remarry will constitute actual substantial damage which is not quantifiable. So therefore, the arbitrator shall be authorized imposing their decree liquidated damages, $250 a day. This goes back almost 30 years ago, this text. That's a fascinating legal term. But liquidated damages means, and we have our attorney here, it means you can't determine how much it is in normal ways. A woman can't remarry. How do you measure that? There's no. So you impose a number. That's a number. In Jewish law, it's likely not collectible. It may be what we call psychological pain, which is comparable to embarrassment. These days, we don't collect this kind of an obligation. And even in the time of the Gemara, there was boshes. We also read about that. Chazal tell us, Nezek Tzar, Ripu Shevus, and Boshes, we all know about those based on Psukim, but even that's only if there's a physical attack, not if it's purely emotion. So therefore, these things don't work. So then they started with the next theme, which is called self-imposed obligations. I obligate myself money. If I won't give you a get, I owe you, I'll pay you $1,000 a day, a fine. $1,000 a day. Is this a question of get me'usa or not? The Rambam is not certain. The Rambam writes in Evan HaEzer and Simon Kuf Lamed Daled that a self-imposed fine, if someone levies a fine on you, which is not appropriate according to halacha. It's a get musa. Why? Take money. Get musa is not only to avoid physical beating or to avoid incarceration. It's also to avoid money taken from you illicitly. It seems to be explicit gemara by Sechta Baba Basra. So therefore, if this fine is not binding, runs into a problem. But make it the way it is binding. Maybe it is binding. However, the Ramah says it should not be done lechatchila, as we say, and there are some authorities who say even b'di'evet it's no good. So therefore, this is not going to fly either. It's not going to fly. Not going to work. It's not going to work. There are other rather complex ways to try to overcome these problems with unconditional obligations and conditional forgivenesses. Quite complex. And we're not going to spend the time tonight going into the complexities and whether it's good or no good. But let's go back to what I consider to be the proper way to do it, which is a simple support agreement. A support agreement says, look, the man agreed to support his wife when they got married. That's what the Ksuba says. Normally, this obligation stands. If, however, the couple separates, we said before, it's a question whether the obligation continues to exist or does not exist. So what we can do is simply say that the man accepts upon himself to support his wife. Not an exaggerated sum. An exaggerated sum is, again, runs into many complexities which we cannot discuss at length at the present time. But a sum which is not at all an exaggeration. An average estimate of how much a person needs to support herself. Now, in the absence of such a document, there can be two ways to argue with this. Number one, I never agreed to it. Certainly legally, I never understood what the Ksuba said, and who knows what. Number two, the sum is too large. I never agreed to this particular sum. Right? And number three, most important, we broke up and it's her fault. And if I'm not obligated by the laws of the Shulchan Aruch. The way to get around all these three is to do it in English, right? And to pick a particular sum, which is of course an estimate. And number three, to recite in the obligation that this obligation shall exist no matter what. Even if it's his fault that the couple separated, the obligation exists nonetheless. This seems to be, even if, what did I say? I'm sorry, I misspoke, thank you. Even if it's her fault, he obligates himself nonetheless. This seems to be something which is found in Nachlat Shiva Simen Tes, which is written by a Talmud of the Taz over 300 years ago, where he writes that if the couple separates and the wife summons her husband to the local bezdin, he has to pay her 10 golden coins per month until there's a reconciliation. What do you mean reconciliation? No, to my mind, that's a euphemism. That means halavai, there should be a reconciliation. But it does not. It seems to me that's what keeps him in bezdin. He's not going to ignore the bezdin with impunity because there is an ongoing running obligation which continues to exist. There are certain technical questions about this obligation. Does it not run afoul of a halachic problem which is called asmachta, which is a contingency obligation, according to the Ramah, if it's an exaggerated obligation. This is not exaggerated. According to the Shulchan Aruch, there are certain ways to overcome asmachta by using the word me'achshav, by having it take effect immediately, which means, doesn't mean it's payable immediately, but it's effective immediately. And there's also something called the bezin choshuv, by admitting that it took place in front of an important bezin, which according to the Ramah overcomes the asmachta issue. That's like Mishkan Shabbos Gevet. It doesn't work. We write in the Ksuba Lo Kasmachta, but if it would be an Asmachta, it wouldn't work. As a matter of fact, we had mentioned, if you may recall, that Rabbi Yashiv Shalita has a tshuva which he's bothered by this. Why isn't every ksuba, in other words, the part over and above the obligatory, the Tosefta's ksuba, why isn't it called asmachta? Because it's a contingency obligation, and often they write large sums. The Sfarim write millions of shkolim. So why isn't that an asmachta? So the answer he gives, which is very important for our purpose, is there's no asmachta in obligations which are undertaken in anticipation of marriage. Based on the Gemara, which tells us that Omdu v'kitshu, hein advarim aniknim ba'amira. That even if they just speak about it, there's no need for a formal kinyan. There's no need for a formal kinyan, therefore cannot be undercut by the fact that it's an asmachta, even if it is an asmachta. That's a very important for our purpose, that was, since our prenuptials are done in anticipation of marriage, that would presumably make them asmachta proof. Yes?
Now this will work, except that not every husband cares about the if it's a normal amount, a few $100 a day, let's say. He'll say, okay.
I'll give it. This, you're right, this prenuptial will not work in two cases. If he's very wealthy or if he's very poor. If he's very poor, he's judgment proof. Take. I have nothing. If he's very wealthy, take. Till you turn white. Take. I have plenty of money. You're right. But the vast majority of people are neither too wealthy nor too poor that doesn't impact upon them. And therefore, it's a very effective tool. I want to say very carefully, this is not a fine in any which way. It's simply a support agreement. Just that it's quantified and it's made even in a situation in which it may be her fault. And therefore, in order to avoid this obligation, he's more likely to give a get the same way as according to strict halacha. In the, let's at least say, 50-50 chance that it really is his fault, he would have to pay the money just based on the regular ksuba. With a certain amount of money, and then that itself would be an incentive for him to give the get. All this does is three things. It translates into English, gives a certain quantity, and it says that it applies even in a situation in which it may be her fault. So by the law of the Rambam, he'd be exempt. Now he makes himself obligated nonetheless, which is not, there's nothing wrong with doing that. There seems to be nothing wrong with that. Yes?
It can also be that she will wrongfully receive the get, like if he is missing an action or something, not in the case when it's somebody's fault, but if it was a time of war, let's say, and he is still alive, and then he comes back later on or something, or if somebody was missing, let's say, September 11th, if they were alive for a month or something in the hospital, and let's say they're going to have an amnesia or something, they'll wind up that she'll receive a get
because he won't
be able to pay.
No. If he's not there, she's not receiving any get. The get can only be given by her husband who's there. It's only an incentive for him to agree to give the get. No bezek can issue a get without the husband. It's only an incentive for him to come and give the get. So having said all this, I'd like to go over the agreement because I think it's very, very important. And you all have copies, right? This is an agreement which is a binding arbitration agreement. It has on it four pages. It's 1, 2, 3, and 4. I think we should start with page 4. That sounds illogical, but page 4 is the instructions. Okay? So let's look together. We'll read it together and see what it says. And if you have any questions, please ask them now, because it's important. We're always able to make corrections. We're open to constructive criticism. I repeat, this is not the Aseres Hadibros, something which was drafted by plain human beings. Yes, with consultation with rabbis, consultation with attorneys, but there always can be room for improvement. Once we're speaking about rabbis and attorneys, I should add that this particular agreement was endorsed 19 years ago plus by three great rabbis in Eretz Yisrael: Rabbi Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, who was the one who actually started this with something he wrote in 1988, and Rabbi Chaim Gedalia Tzimbalist, a Dayan who was then in Av Bezdin in Tel Aviv, was later in the Bezdin HaGadol, and now a retired judge, as we call him, and Rabbi Avadi Yosef. All three of whom signed it in its Hebrew version, in a sort of a primitive version. And two other rabbis here in this country, Rabbi Libis, Zichrono Livracha, who was a Bronx Rav for many years before he moved to Borough Park, and Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz Shalita, who was our Av Bezdin, who also signed it. Those are the five who signed it then. Just last year, we were privileged to receive a tshuva by Rabbi Osho Weiss Shalita, a very important member of the halakha community. It was fairly unknown 19 years ago. We were sitting, I think, somewhere in the Tanya, learning Yom HaValayla, but has since come to the fore, and he wrote a very nice tshuva. As a matter of fact, he even printed it in a little kuntres called Leket Minchas Osher, which was given out at a wedding. I happen to have been in attendance. Chai Shvat Tovshin Ayin Aleph, a Talmud of mine. And lo and behold, in the back of the, I didn't realize it. I saw my wife was at the wedding. He says, look in the back. I wrote a letter. My letter to you is there. Sure enough. He writes over here. Where is it? If I can find it. Let's see. Yes. Page Kuf Samach Tes. It's written to myself and to Rabbi Tzvi Gartner, who was a member of his bezin, as a matter of fact. So the two of us received the tshuva, which starts on page Kuf Samach Tes. It's a 2.5 page tshuva. I'll read you the last paragraph. Etzem atakana zu dover godelhu. And he knows that in places where, without for the shtar, it would have been a disaster. Ad ein kates, toch machlokus v'sin aschinim v'agmas nefesh, she'ein lo shir, v'hodot l'mismach zeh, his garshu toch zman kotzer mitoch haskama v'kobah zeh lezeh. That's how he starts. So he's a big man who's coming on board with a very enthusiastic haskama. He goes into the details, you know, whether this, that, and the halakhic details, which is important, but again, not for this particular shir. So having spoken about the rabbinic endorsements, there have been a lot of legal input here in this country went into this document, but nonetheless, we're always open to suggestions. And as a matter of fact, it has been modified, I should say, over these many years in different ways. We'll try to explain as we go. Instructions. This agreement is intended to facilitate the timely and proper resolution of certain marital disputes. When a couple about to be married signs this agreement, they thereby express their concern for each other's happiness, as well as their concern for all couples marrying in accordance with Jewish law. In other words, you're sure that you're going to live happily till 120. Don't do it for yourself. Do it for the next guy. This works. It works it makes it easy for people. Do it for the next guy. You never know if you're maybe the next guy yourself, but do it for the next guy. Do it so that everyone else should do it. And I think it's a legitimate argument. Let's continue. These tanoim achronim, the reason why that expression is used is because that's what the Nachlat Shiva Simon Test calls it, tanoim achronim, premarital agreement, should be discussed and then signed as far ahead of the wedding day itself as practically feasible. When I meet with a couple, I ask them to sign it right in front of me. I'm going to marry them and I'm going to be the mistaglish in 2 months. Sign right now. What are you waiting for? Do it now. Full background materials and explanations can be accessed at different various websites. As a matter of fact, when I meet them in yeshiva, I go down to the Beis Medrash and have 2 witnesses. While it's preferable for the Mesag Kedushin take responsibility for explaining the background for and implementing the agreement itself, any other knowledgeable rabbi or individual or the couple themselves can coordinate the process. Advice of proper legal counsel on both sides is certainly encouraged. You want to ask a lawyer? The problem with lawyers is, as you know, that they always are concerned about every possible eventuality. I'll tell you a case. I don't want to mention any names, but it happened with someone in this particular community, marrying someone from a different community. And of the 4 parents, 3 of them were lawyers. You will imagine what I had to go through. There's nitpicking with this one. Finally, it was signed. Both the couple is very happily married, Baruch Hashem. But I learned that, you know, when it comes to lawyers, nothing goes so easy. Okay. Binding civil court effect. When property exclusive disagreement is enforceable, it's a binding arbitration agreement in the courts of the United States of America, as well as pursuant to Jewish law halacha. The supervising rabbi should explain this to the parties. This agreement should only be used when the parties expect to reside in the United States upon marriage. Otherwise, it's a problem. Not going into all the details. Choice of options. Alright, it can discuss a number of different things, different alternatives, which we'll discuss in section 4. We'll see that on page 1 momentarily. Okay. It goes through these, just identifies what things. It goes first to the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act, section 307, which is referred to in the in this document, is a general statement of the principles of equal distribution of community property proposed as a model law. It is not the law of any particular state. Why do we use this? Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg wrote a tshuva in which he says there's nothing wrong for individuals, from people, to go to Bezdin and state in advance that they want the Bezdin to decide this based upon the law of New York State. They're not accepting New York State law as such. New York State law as of today. Today is February 2011. We are going into buying a house, and there's real estate law, whatever it may be, and we agreed to be bound that the Bezdin should decide based on this particular. This is not your acceptance of non-Jewish law system as such. Proof, if they change the law next week, it's irrelevant to us. We are just such a corporation by reference. We could agree, we could write on longhand. Whatever it says in the law books, we'll agree to this, to save time. We say the present law of New York State. The law changes next month. We have a fight next year. We're not going to have next year, so we're going to have this year's law. So we're not tying ourselves to the system of New York State law as such. So, Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg. Others disagree. And to try to make everybody happy, we decided to tie that into a particular law of a particular state, but what they call a Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act section, which is just discussing things in general. It may not be exactly the same to the letter of New York, which is equal distribution, or California, which is community property, which means that everything is 50-50, etc. Okay?
Why can't you just have a law of whatever law talks about binding arbitration?
Binding arbitration is very nice, but sometimes the parties do not want the Bezdin to deal with their monetary issues by looking straight in the Shulchan Aruch. They want to have other rules and regulations to be utilized by the Bezdin making their determination. If they want to do that, well, what? So let's say equal distribution. What does that mean? So in New York it means such, another state it means such. So in order to avoid that little complication of a particular state, they use a broader general act, which is not of any particular state, to avoid any problem of what we call Easter our cause, or accepting the legal system of a different jurisdiction. That's what it says. Okay, we're going to discuss the various options, and they're discussed at length over here. We'll read it in the agreement itself. Here's explained at some length. Okay, witnesses. There must be two witnesses to each signature. Again, it's not a halachic requirement. In Jewish law, as we just heard from Ashir Tefer, from Rabbi Cohen, you sign your own name, it's binding. But just to play it safe, we require signatures as well. Notarization, it's a big question. Do you require it? Do you not require? They pulled off something here in New York State that the officiating rabbi can notarize a prenuptial. How do you like that? We have enough pull to have that. So I sign as the notary. I'm not a notary public for anything else, but for this I am. I'm the officiating rabbi. Fascinating. And additional forms, saving of the form, further information. I want to cut short some of these instructions because I want to get to the agreement itself and I want to end on time. In an emergency, the two cell phone numbers. If you know, I'm getting married now. I can't wait till they open on Monday morning. A lot of Sunday weddings. So these two rabbis were willing to put their cell phones out there for people to contact them in case of emergency. Okay? With this introduction, which is page 404, we're going to start page 104. Okay? Yes?
It has to be done before a wedding?
Yeah, prenuptial. It's called a prenuptial. Oh, good question. What's wrong with a postnuptial agreement? In strict halacha, paradoxically, a postnuptial may be better than a prenuptial. Why? Because we shall see soon that just to make it safe, although it may not be necessary, based on what we said earlier, the husband waives his rights to his wife's earnings. This waiver may not be effective before they're married. So from the halakhic perspective, it's probably better being a postnuptial. In American law, I'm told by the attorneys, it's not a slam dunk that a postnuptial will work. It's something called consideration. In this case, the consideration is, you'll marry me because you'll sign the agreement. But once you're married already, that consideration no longer exists, so it's not as ironclad in American law. That's what I was told. I'm not an attorney. It makes sense. Sounds right. You have a Harvard lawyer here. He says it sounds right. We can rely upon him. Okay. So let's now turn our attention to page 104. Okay. Again, the top that tells you there's two pages and a notarization page. Okay. Fine. Agreement is made on a certain day, a certain month, a certain year, a certain place. Husband writes his name to be. Wife writes his name and address to be. The parties who intend to be married in the near future hereby agree as follows. One, should a dispute arise in the parties after they are married so that they do not live together as husband and wife, they agree to refer the marital dispute to the Bezdin of America. President of the United States of America, that's its official name, fine. Two, the decision of the President of America shall be fully enforceable in any court of competent jurisdiction. Okay? That makes sense. Three, the parties agree that the President of America has exclusive jurisdiction to decide all issues related to a get, Jewish divorce, as well as any issues arising in this agreement, which means the obligation found in this agreement, or the ketubah, and tanoim, Jewish premarital agreements, and to the husband to be and wife to be. Each of the parties agrees to appear in person for the Beth of America at the demand of the other party. So far, so good. If we stop right over here, we're really doing nothing much more than Rabbi Moshe's tshuva. Rabbi Moshe says you can agree, as Rabbi Pear does every single wedding, I think. You go to a particular Besdin if there's a problem. What's new starts in starts a little bit in section 4. Well, as we shall see, what's really new is not until section 7. But section 4, we're going to go on.
I'm just curious.
Sure.
What happens if the fellow says, I want to go to a Hasidic court now, and I don't want to go to the Besdin of America?
No, well, if he thought that before he got married, he should take a pen, cross out Besdin of America, and put down the Besdin of Satmar, or whatever it may be. But once he agreed to go Besdin of America, presumably it's binding. Okay, like the guy said, I don't want to go to the diamond club. I want to go to the real estate club. Let them decide my diamond dispute. So you can do it in advance, but not once you're in the club. You already agreed. 4A. Okay? Regarding additional financial issues, that's beyond the ksuba, the tnoim, and this agreement itself, is optional. Okay, let's take a look and see what it says. 4A. And it's a little bit hard to read because it's taken off it's put in a little gray background to show that it's optional. The parties agree that the Besdin of America is authorized to decide all monetary disputes, including division of property and maintenance that may arise between them. We choose to have it applied to our arbitration agreement. And they both sign. Next, they decide they want it, the Besdin should discuss all these issues that may arise based on principles of equal distribution law customary employed in the U.S. as found in the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act. What this means is a woman may say, listen, I know that in strict halacha, if I put him through medical school, this is the classical case, right? I put him through medical school, so in halacha, I'm not entitled to anything from that. He's a doctor, so he's a doctor. He makes all the money, and I'm left with not so much. Whereas in American law, equal distribution, she put him through medical school, she's entitled to a significant chunk, maybe even 50% of his medical earnings. I'm not sure what the law says exactly on these things. But the equitable means, it can vary by this, by that, all the different factors. And some women want this, they feel if they go to a plain Besdin, they're losing out, quote unquote, as compared to what they can get in court. I say, well, if you both agree, more power to you. I have no objection to that. They both have to agree before they're married, though. If they don't agree before they're married, and then she says later on, I don't want to go to Besdin because in Besdin I won't get as much money as I'm going to get equal distribution, in my humble opinion, she's not entitled to that money by Torah law. She's not entitled. And although there is a principle of Dina de Machusa Dina, it does not apply to two Jews in a dispute between them. And although there's a concept called Minig HaSochen that people are accustomed to do that, it doesn't seem to apply in this particular case. I always give the example. If people are going to lawyers to go through all of their issues, then it's arguable that since lawyers are experts in secular law and they each hired lawyers before they went into a particular contract or agreement, that they had in mind to be governed by secular law, hopefully by a Besdin, by secular law. But if they go to rabbis and not to lawyers, it seems to me that they are not thinking about secular law when they marry. But of course, if they fill this out, then they're saying what they want. They want either straight halacha, or they want equal distribution, or 4A3, they want community property. What that means is 50-50. She may say, I want 50-50. If he agrees, he agrees. I have no problem. Yes, sir. It's a very good question. When it comes to monetary matters, you have a rule called kol tanai shel b'mamon kayim. I can agree to anything I want. According to Abzalman Nechemia, you can even agree to the particular laws of a particular state at this time, not to their whole system, this particular law. In order to not to rely upon that, we changed it to what's called relying on the Uniform Marriage and Divorce Act, which is not the law of any particular state. I mean, they agree that they want their property divided in a different way. There's nothing wrong with that. It's not going against any Torah principles.
So two Jews agree to go to a secular court?
Not allowed.
Not allowed.
Absolutely not allowed. Okay.
Even if it's for a monetary?
Absolutely not allowed. Section 4B, regarding parenting disputes, is optional. Unless this option is chosen, the Bezel will hold out the restrictions to discuss these matters. So, right, they want the parents in this entire all disputes, child custody, child support, visitation, as well as any other disputes that may arise between them, and they choose. I'm dealing right now with a case where all this was signed. They signed 4A1, and they signed 4B, and the husband, we met him twice, 2 weeks ago, and just 2 days ago, and he's still draying, he's still this, and he doesn't want to give the get, and there's all kinds of things, and we hopefully that this will help him to give the get. Only one problem, he has no money. So if he has no money, as he said, there are two other cases which are pending right now, which are pending before courts, believe it or not. One, the party claims that it's a forgery. It wasn't a signature. We heard from Rabbi Kohn about forgery, Mezuyev. It's hard to imagine that's forged because in that particular case, there's an affidavit from the rabbi who in front of whom he signed it. Affidavits from the two people who signed it. There's even, I think, a video. I think they may have signed it at the wedding, which is not a good idea, but there may be a video. And despite that fact, the judge is dilly-dallying. So I don't know what's taking so long. That's one case. There's another case before a different court, a different state, where the person said, coercion. What's the coercion? She wouldn't marry me without it. You got to scratch your head. So, you know, in that case, every contract is coercion because he wouldn't sell the building to me unless I agreed to a certain amount of money. Meanwhile, the judge hasn't decided that one either. So we are hoping to get positive results in these two cases. Yes?
Why would any woman want to sign the number one choice?
Were you talking about 1A1 as opposed to 1A2 or 1A3?
Right.
That's a good question. A woman wants that the halacha should determine what the din is. And the halacha is...
the halacha, you know, it's a halacha, but like it's still mostly not as fair to women as...
No, I reject your word fair. I think the Torah is the ultimate fair system. There's nothing else that's more fair than the Torah. It may not be as profitable for the woman who wants to get her husband's medical practice profits for the rest of his life. Now, whether she's entitled according to Jewish law is a different matter. So we're not going to go into that now. But people don't sign different things. Okay, but 4C, I think, is a very important thing. The Bezdin of America may consider the respective responsibilities of either or both of the parties for the end of the marriage as an additional but not exclusive factor in determining the distribution of marital property and maintenance, should such a determination be authorized by Section 4A or 4B. What does this mean? In America, there's now no-fault divorce. There's no-fault insurance, no-fault divorce, no-fault that, no-fault. Doesn't matter. In other words, for argument's sake, in American law, the woman could run off with her boyfriend. She makes no bones about it. I was tired of this guy. My boyfriend is stronger, or he's taller, or he's more handsome. And she can be straight up, and that's why I ran away with him and left my husband and my family. And I want this money. In American law, no fault. They're not interested in whose fault the marriage breakup is, as a general rule. We, as halachists, cannot abide that. We have to take it into account, you know, when it's relevant. Hence, a paragraph 4C. Fine. Let's now turn our attention to the next page. I'll tell you how it affects it. Let's say, for argument's sake, there would be a normal obligation of a man to give X dollars to a wife. Because after all, you know, by the laws of equity, what's fair, and remember, as we shall see soon, the Bezdin is empowered to employ equity, as it was called, the pshara, which is fairness. That's, as we said before, this is fair in the eyes of the Bezdin. What's fair in the eyes of the Bezdin may not be the same in a case in which the husband beat his wife, and as a result of that she has to get out, or in the case in which the woman was adulterous, in the case she also has to get out. Not the same as in the eyes of a Bezdin.
If they pick 4A2, what does 4C do to the choice of 4A2?
No, so that's exactly the point. That 4C is...
It doesn't
override it completely.
The Beis Din is going to end up deciding what it thinks is the right resolution. It doesn't matter what
it looks. No, it will take into account what they sign, which is B or C, you know, A2 or A3. They may take that into account, but they may tweak it, you know, to whatever extent they decide to think appropriate, based on the responsibilities, as they call it. Fine. I don't want to run out of time. Yeah, what's your question? If it's important, I'll take it anyway. What's the question?
If this woman is running away from somebody, and now she, you know, like the bed, what are they going to say to the husband? You don't have to pay her support, right? Now he's free of his obligation because it's her fault.
Right.
And he's going to say, but I wanted to. Now she, the bed is permitting her to be an aguna. That he's taking away the solution.
Again. We're not saying that the man shouldn't give a get. I think it's appropriate the man should give a get as fast as possible, such a case. But to come, she should come with clean hands. You know, if she's running away with her boyfriend and living with him while she's officially married to this guy, and she's saying I'm an innocent woman and I'm a tzedekis and I want to get and I'm an aguna, you got to think twice.
So he's now angry at her for being a bad woman, and he's not giving her a get. And he's holding her up. And she's saying, yes, I admit I'm a bad woman, but I want to get my get. I want to go on and live with my boyfriend.
Right.
So the Bezdin is saying, we're gonna not use this whole forcing agreement.
The Bezdin will do what it thinks is appropriate. They have a lot of latitude. Come on, I really want to finish this. We have only one page left, page 2. Page 3 is simply an authorization. I'm not going to look at it. You can just read it yourself. And then, as I said, the rabbi can do it. Let's try to finish page 2. Okay, so there's a lot of boilerplate here. Number 5 is boilerplate. If you don't perform an agreement, you're liable for costs, common jurisdiction, reasonable attorney's fees. This is typical boilerplate. 6 tells you how the Bezdin will decide. Jewish law halacha, or what's called pshara krova ladin, which is in accordance with the principles of Jewish law, except as specifically provided otherwise in this agreement. And they waive their right to contend this in another rabbinical court or arbitration forum. They agree to abide by the published rules and procedures of the Bezdin. The Bezdin will follow its own rules and procedures, etc., etc. Number 7. Here's the most important of all the paragraphs. They agree to come to the Bezdin, and the failure of either party before the Bezdin upon reasonable notice, it may issue its decision despite the defaulting party's failure to appear. That's important in case they don't show up. It may impose costs and other penalties as legally permitted. Furthermore, husband-to-be acknowledges that he recites and accepts the following. It's in italics, because it's now in the words of the husband-to-be. I hereby now, me'achshav, that's a halachic term, as we mentioned earlier, to overcome asmachta. I obligate myself to support my wife-to-be from the date of our domestic marriage residence together shall cease for whatever reasons, in other words, even if it's her fault, at the rate of $150 per day. Now, when it started off, it was 50. Then it moved to 100. Then it moved to 150. $150 a day, so it's 50-something thousand dollars a year. Is that a lot or a little? Depends who you ask. For some people, it's a lot. For some people, it's too little. Well, that's exactly the point. It's calculated to be an average. But then, what happens if there's a crazy inflation? So, there's a parenthesis here. Calculated the day of our marriage, adjusted to CPI, etc. In lieu of my Jewish law obligation of support, so long as the two of us remain married according to Jewish law, okay, that's what we said before, he can obligate himself to support even if the separation is for argument's sake, her fault. Even if she has another source of income or earnings, he shouldn't say that he's not obligated because she has enough independent support. Furthermore, I waive my halachic rights to my wife's earnings for the period that she is entitled to the above stipulated sum. We mentioned before it may be too early. So look at this now, and I recite that I shall be deemed to have repeated this waiver at the time of our wedding. That is a some fancy footwork, which may or may not work in halacha. I'm willing to agree to that. My personal view is that, based on what we said earlier, he's probably not entitled to her earnings anyway, because she works much harder than she's required to do by knitting a few little bit in the house, which the Mishnah requires in the Sechta Ksubas. I acknowledge that I have now, me'aksha, effected the above obligation by means of a Kenyan, former Jewish transaction, and an esteemed chosh of Bezdin, as prescribed by Jewish law. You don't have to do it. Hodas baldin kemeidim dam. If you agree that you did it, you admit that you did it, it's as if you did it, even though you never did it. Now, the problem's going to be, what happens if the woman decides not to live an easy life? Hey, great. I have $150 a day. Shine. However, this support obligation shall terminate if wife-to-be refuses to appear upon due notice for the President of America, or in the event the wife-to-be fails to abide by the decision or recommendation of the President of America. So therefore, for example, if she'll go to secular court, and the Bezdin will just say, listen, now, lady, you can't have your cake and eat it too. If you either go to secular court, don't say you're in a guna. Don't come in and with this piece of paper. Furthermore, wife-to-be waives her right to collect any portion of the support obligation attributable to the period preceding the date of a reasonable attempt to provide a written notification to the husband-to-be. She intends to collect the above sum. Said written notification must include wife-to-be's notarized signature. Why is this in here? We had a case of a couple that they had a question of a divorce, and the husband was very willing to give the divorce. There were certain issues back and forth. He never said for a minute he's not going to give the divorce, but things slept on, there were back and forth motions here and there. Maybe they were in court. I don't even know what it was. After 3 years, he gave her a get, okay? Because after that, till then, it was just things were dragging on. And then she gave him a bill for up to $100,000 for all the back pay. And it's a very chilling effect on the husband. They have to pay money in back payments, which you never was surprised earlier. So to solve that problem going forward, this additional sentence, these two sentences were added. Suffice to say, which I can't go into the details now, that even in that case, the Bezdin did not, at the end, order the man to pay money for that period of time. Okay, the rest is boilerplate, one or more duplicates, fully enforced arbitration agreement, the severability. Now, this is interesting. In section number 9, second half of that section, the parties agreed to effect this agreement in full form and purpose. They accept now, through the Jewish mechanism of Kimli, whatever minority views determined by the Bezdin of America that needed to effectuate the obligation contained in section 7, and the procedures and jurisdictional mandates found in section 1, 2, 3, and 6 of this agreement. What does that mean? That there could be disputes of it in halacha. So the parties agree now there is a legitimate halachic position which the Bezdin accepts, and the Bezdin is accepting it in order to help see to it that things work out. They are going to be bound by that, even though there's another opinion which otherwise they might want to bring to the table. Finally, section 10, each of the parties acknowledges that he or she has been given the opportunity prior to signing the agreement to consult with his or her own rabbinic advisor and legal advisor, and the obligations are excellent to all legal and halakhic requirements. The husband and wife sign, there are two witnesses. End of document. This is where it ends. Ladies and gentlemen, this document, I believe, is important. I strongly encourage that it be signed. I'm dealing now with a number of cases where individuals who were in schools, not discussing in the Haredi world, that for some reason has not accepted it, but even what they will call in our world, one was a Stern College graduate, one's a graduate of a high school where I speak every single year as by their request, high school seniors, girls, the girls' high school, and she was in that class and she heard what I said, but they told her, well, you don't really need it, and now she really needs it. And that's the problem. She's saying to me, you know, help me out. So I learned from experience, as Rabbi Usher Weiss Shalita writes in that last paragraph, that there are cases in which such a document, which is halakhically valid, can save grief. We are here to save grief. That's one of our jobs in life, to try to save personal grief, to try to save aguna issues, which can lead to the worst possible results. And I believe it's a very, very important form. And I think that everyone should be encouraged to sign it. If you have children getting married, or maybe soon have grandchildren getting married, or other relatives, encourage it. There are some of my colleagues who will not do a wedding without it being signed. Since we are in a Riverdale setting, I will conclude with a Riverdale story, which is meaningful on many levels. There was a couple that was getting married. The woman belonged to the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale, and the man was a student in the Yeshiva of Far Rockaway. Now, how that happened exactly, I don't know, but it seems to be a bit of a chasm, but, you know, love conquers all. And Rabbi Weiss refused to allow the wedding to take place unless it was a prenuptial agreement. The Masada Kedushin was not Rabbi Per himself, who was a Rosh Hashiva, but a Rabbi Kaufman, who's now in Waterbury. He was at that time the assistant Rosh Hashiva, or whatever his title was, in Yeshiva Far Rockaway. So he calls me up and says, what's going on over here? What am I going to do with this? So I told him, Rabbi Kaufman is the son-in-law of the famous Raphael Cohen, who is a world-famous Pesach. I said to him, you know, I spoke to your father-in-law about this a few years ago, and I presented him, and he said he thought it was okay. He said, yeah, but he heard rumors that Rabbi Yashiv has problems with it. So I have a slide pulled out of my file, the letter which is dated, Tesvav Sivan Tovshin Nunhei, the Chvod Rav Agon of Shrabba Fire Cohen Shlita. And I'm writing to explain what the problems that Rabbi Yashiv had, supposedly, with this. The main, only that's been printed in his name, which was printed by Rabbi Gartner himself back in 1988, was that the Rabbi Yasha was afraid that the Chosim will not understand what's in it, and he'll just sign it without looking, and he feels that perhaps it's not obligatory in such a case, which is a problem. Why? It says in the Shulchan Aruch, if you sign something, it's binding. You can't say it didn't understand any, then your signature is worthless. Right? He doesn't say that either. So, as a matter of fact, I was dealing with a situation and I thought that someone might claim they didn't understand it. So I called up Rabbi Gartner in Eretz Yisrael, and he said that he wrote then, back in 88, that this may only apply in Israel. Couldn't help you just sign without looking. But in America, where people are arguing about it, the proof is that they argued for weeks when all the lawyers were involved in that case I described earlier, that this objection perhaps would not exist. The issue of Asmachta is not printed in Rabbi Yashiv's name. His associate, Rabbi Morgenstern, said that maybe it's a problem. I mentioned to you earlier a reason why it might not be a problem, according to Rabbi Yashiv, because it's in anticipation of marriage. A third problem was we shouldn't want to, quote, force the husband to give a get when he doesn't want to give it, even though the obligation is valid. I don't quite understand what that means. What's wrong with that? And fourth, he thought of going to the secular court, but of course, that was just a misunderstanding. In any event, as a result of my letter to Rabbi Feivel Cohen Shlita, I was as upfront as I could be, he decided to allow his son-in-law to proceed with the prenuptial agreement in that particular case. So I hope that it's sitting in a drawer somewhere and that a couple is still happily married now almost 16 years later. But there is discussions with rabbis from a wide range of circles as far as the matter is concerned. Yes, sir?
Do you ever hear of a case where this actually went to as far as the secular court to...
As I mentioned, there are two pending cases right now.
No, but that was to the benefit.
No, pending in secular court.
Secular.
Right now. In one case, the husband is claiming, the husband's attorney claims the signature was forged. How that can be, that's mind-boggling, if the affidavits from the two people who witnessed it, and the rabbi, and it's even maybe even be a video, but that's pending. Another case, he says he was coerced. What was the coercion? Was there a gun? No, she wouldn't marry me if I wouldn't sign it. How that can be coercion, to my simple mind, is also not to be understood. So I'm hopeful that these will be determined properly by the appropriate secular authorities. I want to thank you all for coming. Good vach. Next week we're discussing the New York State get law, another very controversial issue. B'siyata v'shamayim.